Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Integrity Matters by Eternity. My name is Chooks, and with me in the house today is Dr. Guy Curtis of Western Australia. Guy, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do at the University of Western Australia and possibly your area of research focus?
Sure. So I'm an academic in the School of Psychological Science. I have particular interest in academic integrity among the things that I do. So I've been conducting some research on academic integrity dating back more than 15 years now. And it's really become the increasing focus of what I do in research. In addition to that, I am involved in the application of academic integrity and helping others learn about academic integrity. I'm the chair here of our academic integrity advisory group, and I've been involved in projects for Tertiary Education Quality Standards Agency in developing academic integrity materials and information for academics around Australia.
Excellent. Nice to meet you. And today we're looking at exploring the concept of academic cheating and how we could potentially start investigating or detecting cheating amongst our students and universities' higher learning. So my first question is around the concept of the psychology of academic cheating. How do you describe that, and what would you say are some causes of academic cheating among students in universities?
Sure. So psychology is a really broad subject, but the main focus of psychology is human behavior and mental processes. So if you take something like cheating as an aspect of human behavior, it's something that people do sometimes, and then our psychologists ask the question, why do we do what we do? And there can be all sorts of things that factor into engaging in a behavior like cheating. It can be what people think, how people feel, what their attitudes are, and their personality might predispose them to engage in cheating. So all sorts of things that we can measure as individual differences among people, like their personality traits, like their, self-efficacy, essentially how good they feel they are at doing what they do, particularly in an educational context. Lots of these sorts of things can predict engagement in cheating and plagiarism. I've been doing some work recently looking at personality traits. So there's some particular personality traits that we call the dark triad that are associated with bad behavior, which is Machiavellianism, narcissism, and psychopathy. And these are personality traits that seem to be better predictors of students engaging in academic misconduct than some of the more traditional personality traits that are more widely known, like conscientiousness and that kind of thing. With emotions like stress, for example, we know negative emotions are associated with engagement in cheating. So when students are placed under stress, when students are feeling vulnerable, they can be more susceptible to cheating. So there's so many different things that we can explore, and what we're beginning to look at is how some of these factors fit together, not just what individual factors are predicting our cheating.
So that's quite interesting. You talk about stress, personal stress, and how that affects cheating. Now that we're in, we've suddenly pivoted to, with the pivot to remote and hybrid learning, would you say there's been any data that's been shown to prove that there's been an increase or decrease in the level of cheating in our institutions?
Sure. So it's a bit hard to pin down because with the big move to online learning driven by the COVID-19 pandemic, a lot of the data is new and it's hard to compare with data historically. One of the studies that has come out recently showed that there was a big increase in students using essentially homework help type sites that can sometimes provide things like an answer to a question that a student has on a test in front of them. Now, students using those sites, they're typically sites that aren't endorsed by their higher education institution, and often using them that way would be considered cheating. But the evidence is that students are potentially using those more. What I've seen data, at least early days, on post-coronavirus pandemic is that there seems to be some increases in academic misconduct, cheating and plagiarism. There's all sorts of factors driving that. Stress may well be one of them. Certainly the unfamiliarity with the environment, the availability of help from staff and all sorts of things could be contributing to it as well.
So it sounds like there will be data at some point down the track, and I'm not sure who's doing research in that field. But now my next question is along the lines of thinking about proven strategies that can support creating that culture of academic integrity within institutions. Here at Turnitin, we're very focused on promoting products that support what we term citizens of integrity. So from your experience, what would you say are some proven strategies that that have worked in terms of fostering the culture of academic integrity?
Sure. So when I think about, you know, what an average student is like and what they want to do, and at least what they tell us they want to do, most people want to do the right thing. In general, most people don't want to come to university and blatantly cheat their way through. But what we do find is that new students in particular who are learning rules of academic conduct or may have come out of a school experience where they had different expectations around academic conduct, that education is really the most important thing in terms of, say, learning the skills involved in properly referencing and citing the sources that they use in written work. Now, a lot of literature over time has talked about issues like character and being of good character to do the right thing, but you can't be of good character if you don't know how to be of good character. So actually the skills of referencing are really important. And certainly the one study I've was involved in, we looked at a mastery-based task where students get to practice over and over again the skills of referencing. And what we found was not only did that improve their ability to do their referencing correctly, but it also improved their attitudes towards academic misconduct. And what that suggests to me is once you know how to do the right thing, you start to perceive that doing the right thing is fairly easy, and therefore you think, well, everyone should be able to do this. So really upskilling and education is really very important. Beyond that, a really big impact on any kind of organisation, whether it's universities or anything else, is leadership. And it's one of my other areas of research interest in psychology and academic integrity, is leadership. Leaders have a disproportionate influence on the culture of organisations. So if you've got senior leadership support for academic integrity in an institution, then you can get that flow-on impact down to the academics and the students, emphasising that it's important, that it's something that you should pay attention to and it's something you should know about.
Thanks for sharing that. I think you sort of touched on this. I'm looking along the lines of in institutions with the potential increase in academic cheating in the institutions, what would you say are some practical strategies that academics who might be watching this can take into consideration when trying to reduce the prevalence of academic cheating in their institutions?
If you want students to complete a test and you want them to complete it individually in a closed book kind of a way, then it's a good idea for them not to have easy access to answers. So taking questions from test banks is something that a lot of academics do, test banks that go along with textbooks. But those test banks are very easily accessible online for most students. If an instructor can get it, the chances are a student can get it as well. So unsupervised online tests are great if students are practicing work over and over again to build up their skills. But if they're for marks, they're very easy for students to cheat to get those marks. Similarly, one of the things that's important to whether students cheat or not is whether they're happy with their university course. if they're satisfied with the learning and teaching environment, if they think the academic cares, then they're more likely to do the right thing. If they think the academic doesn't care, then they may not care so much about doing the right thing. And so academics showing that they're putting effort into assessments, explaining to students why the assessment is there and what it's helping them to learn, making it topical and interesting and engaging, showing enthusiasm for the topic, are all good things that academics can do to help students engage with the topic themselves and be less likely to cheat when they're doing that. But certainly there's a lot of things that academics and universities can do to dissuade students from cheating beyond what they're doing educationally. In addition, really, the having some kind of means of detecting what kinds of cheating students engage in is really important as well. So for something like copy-paste plagiarism, text-matching stuff with Turnitin is, of course, ideal because that will pick that up for students and ideally used educationally where students can submit in advance and get some feedback on whether they've forgotten to include a reference or something like that. It's a really good way to go. There's also some telltale signs of where students have outsourced work, that is, had it written by other people that academics can become familiar with. There are some really good sources of information about what those are. Oftentimes it can be something as simple as looking at the document properties of a Word document students have submitted and seeing that the author is someone other than the student, which happens from time to time and might be the start of having a hint that wasn't really the student who wrote what it is that they submitted.
Are there any other telltale signs of academic cheating when academics are reviewing submitted assessments from students that they should be aware of? And I'm only asking because one of the conversations I've been having in prior episodes is one of the need to actually make academic integrity someone's job. And I think that's capitalism from memory. So we don't know when we're going to get to that in many institutions, making that someone else's job. But for academics who are currently on site, what would you say are some telltale signs of academic cheating?
Sure. So the academic's job in detecting cheating comes at a few levels. So sometimes in a big class, you might have tutors and other people who are markers, a unit coordinator above them, and then within an academic organisational unit of some kind, someone who might be involved specifically or designated specifically in investigating academic misconduct cases. So really the first step is what markers pick up, and markers have to be trained to look for telltale signs. The unit coordinators are usually people with a bit more experience and therefore they might have a bit more experience in also seeing and judging what might be academic misconduct. And then you may have some kind of investigator in a role that has more experience still and potentially more training as well in what to look for. So often markers will get really an intuitive sense that something's just not quite right. Like, you know, there's something in the assignment that doesn't seem like what all the other students are writing. So it might be some strange references, some references from outside the academic area, for example. So for us in psychology, if someone's suddenly including a number of references to history, things, we wonder why are you including all these references to history things, and particularly if they've outsourced their work, it could be the case that someone has a bit of familiarity with history. They've just been asked to write a 1500 word assignment, so they're putting a few things they know in along with the new stuff that they're including to meet the guidelines of the assignment. As I said previously, the metadata of a paper, so document properties. What kind of, how long was the editing time is an interesting thing, for example. A document that has a very short editing time is possibly a document that a student has pasted in from another document. A document that has an author other than the student is something to be aware of. The reference list can have some telltale signs of cheating as well. So if a student's paper has used some kind of reference manager like EndNote or Mendeley or something like that. If they're a first-year student, second-year students, unlikely they'll know how to use those things, and that, but they're the kind of things that more experienced writers or more senior students might use. And you can really, in investigating these things, you have to talk to the student, and you can ask a student, you know, what referencing software did you use, or have you heard of referencing software, or something like that. And if they're unsure about it, or they can't show you how they use it, it's a telltale sign that someone else has written it. There's lots of them. As I said, there's some good sources around. Tertiary Education Quality Standards Agency have a guide for investigators on their website for detecting problematic issues in student assignments, and that's well worth a look for people who want to look at least a beginning guide to what to look for.
Do you feel that we are equipped, and in terms of resources and time, to actually go deeper in terms of investigation? I'll give you an example. Let's say most universities will have marking capped at maybe, say, 20 minutes per student. When you start finding all those things, it means there needs to be a level of investigation per student. Do you feel that we're better equipped, one, as institutions, to do this better? Would you say academics actually carve the time to do this?
Yeah, one of the big impediments to investigating academic misconduct is the time that markers have to mark. So if a marker is paid a rate per hour, and that's pretty tight on the amount of words that they have to read, then there's not a great deal of motivation for them to go, oh, this reference looks a bit dodgy, or go look up the reference and see whether that really is a real paper, or whether this paper really said what the student is saying that the paper said, or whatever it is that they're worried about. So those kinds of things that can dissuade people from investigating, obviously not having the time is a big problem. Tracy Bretag, who was at the University of Western Australia, University of South Australia, and a big advocate of academic integrity, often said that institutions have to give their staff enough time to deal with academic integrity issues. For people who are in some kind of investigator role, that should definitely include some kind of workload time allocation. Within my school, I'm the investigator for academic conduct problems. So I get a certain number of sort of hours per year. And what I find is that those hours of work pack into certain times around when assignments are being submitted each semester. For example, we might have here 1,600 first-year students, and we might have 10 of them who get referred to me for further discussion beyond problems in their referencing. And that obviously takes a bit of my time. We have paperwork and other reporting and things like that, but I am given a time allocation to do it. Without that, it would be a struggle, of course. So, yes, staff need the time to do the investigation.
Yeah, I do agree with that. And I think that's one of the things we need to start thinking more critically about at a leadership level at universities, is how, if we're going to want to combat the academic cheating, we've got to provide the resources to do that. So thanks for sharing that. I think you already started talking about the assessment design aspect in terms of securing assessment from academic cheating. Are there any other strategies in terms of an academic thinking about an assessment from conception to its delivery? What are some things they can take into consideration in that design process?
Sure. So assessment design has to include, it is really what you're trying to do is get at learning outcomes that you're trying to teach within a unit, or that you're wanting students to learn within a unit. And I'll particularly say for higher education, it's a co-produced outcome. It's what the teachers teach, but it's also what the students do for themselves. So sometimes what you're wanting them to do is go and look up new information, read things, and get out of that what they need in order to meet learning outcomes. Now, when you then, as a marker, come to assess that, you need some kind of grading criteria that also match up to the learning outcomes and standards that would indicate what kind of grade against that criteria, or what kind of work against that criteria leads to a certain mark. All of that stuff communicated to students in advance seems to be helpful in reducing their cheating. So if you've designed your assessment, thought about how you were going to assess it, and communicated to students what the expectations are, that's all a lot easier for them to try to meet what's expected of them and try to follow rules in doing so. There are certain things in assessment design that can be done to reduce the instance of plagiarism, cheating and outsourcing, things that can prompt students to do the right thing, things that can give students a chance to check whether their referencing is right, such as putting their papers through, turn it in advance of submission, but also things like having a reflective component where they think about how they learnt, for example, or think about what they learnt, or write about how they could apply what they've learnt in a real life situation. Those reflective components are great because it's quite hard for anyone else to do them. Consolidating information in your memory, speaking as a psychologist, is done much better if you think about how you can apply what it is that you know. So those kinds of things are not just assessment designed to combat cheating and plagiarism, but just good assessment designed to enhance learning is really something that academics should be thinking about.
I think one other thing that I'm seeing becoming very common is an opportunity to do the Viva kind of exams, a 5-minute reflection, talking through your thinking process, and I think that really works well. The only caveat to that is, does the academic have time to deal with 500 students in a class?
Yeah.
So that's another angle we need to look at it. I think you already touched a little bit about technology and academic cheating. With the current move to online assessment, we know that students are doing assessments online and they're doing it via EdTech. What role does technology have in supporting that level of detection and investigating contract cheating?
Sure. So one of the things I've recently been working on was a review of historical trends in academic integrity, basically historical trends in the prevalence of students' engagement in plagiarism and cheating. And there's only a handful of studies that have given similar students similar questions at different points in time to see whether the amount of students who are engaging in various kinds of plagiarism and cheating are changing. In the last 30 years, so say between about 1990 and 2020, 2021, what we can see actually across the three studies that have tracked things in this way is that academic integrity breaches, academic cheating and plagiarism have trended downwards. It surprises a lot of people. But one of the things that fits into that timeline is the uptake of the internet and then the uptake of text matching software. What I think people were worried about with the internet as academics and cheating is really students can find anything and they can copy anything and they can paste anything. Someone very adroitly commented that if students can find it, then markers can find it too. And then a system like Turnitin will do that with a fair degree of automaticity that makes it even easier for markers and for students to know, for example, when they've copied and pasted something and forgot to put a reference on it. So the trend downwards in prevalence of plagiarism over time seems to relate very nicely to the internet. The other thing the internet does is it gives you the opportunity to train students better in some way. So you can do things like a competency-based task that they practice over and over again until they get their referencing right. However, the pandemic situation is a whole nother kettle of fish because of the isolation, the stress, the disengagement with teaching staff, that not only are students submitting work online and looking up their sources online and potentially doing more tests online, but they're also trying to learn from people talking to them online. It's harder, and because it's harder, whether they can keep up with all the requirements of them, including the requirements around academic integrity, is a question we don't quite know the answer to yet. Although, so I've said earlier results from studies are showing that academic integrity problems may be increasing since the COVID-19 pandemic.
All right, so we're going to get into a more trickier question, which is around the need to investigate and gather evidence that's going to support a student's assessment that's involved in an academic misconduct case. Have you got any, from your experience, well, how would you go about coaching an academic who wants to get better at gathering this evidence?
What often happens with suspected academic misconduct is that it's usually plagiarism. That's typically the most common thing, or it's often collusion, that is two students in the same class having worked together. Ideally, having a tool like Turnitin, what people can do is they can look at the Turnitin report and see what text matches to what other sources, or what text matches to other students in the same unit. But there are a few little tricks that are worth knowing for people who are unfamiliar with using these systems. So you can print out a Turnitin report, and that printed out Turnitin report is static, and it might show a match of a bit of text to a particular source or something like that. But if you go into Turnitin online on a computer, what you can do is turn on and off particular matches. So you can see, for example, whether something that looked like it came from two or three sources in the original report might have all just come from one, but what Turnitin has matched one bit to one place and one bit to another place. Or you might get a match to several students within a unit for one student, and that can often happen if they're writing on the same topic. They might have a few references in common. They might have a cover sheet that matches up between all the assignments or something like that. You can filter out one student at a time to see which student one has the highest level of match to. And again, that kind of stuff can be helpful. But beyond that, it's then really important in an investigation process to talk to the students and get their side of the story, because often you'll find that they have a reasonable explanation for why there's a match that to text that's been written by someone else, and other times they will they'll simply say, "Oh, whoops, yes, no, I should have known better. I copied this from somewhere," but you have no idea what their actual situation is until you've talked to them. Whether there might have been some mitigating circumstances that might have been unwell, probably should have got an extension but didn't. These kinds of things you just don't know until you've talked to them. It varies institution by institution. For my institution, academics who want to conduct those kinds of interviews can refer them on to the one person in their school who does that and save themselves the time. And what I'd say for people who are in those interviewing roles is to have a standard set of questions that you ask all students that you can adjust a bit, particularly asking students how they went about researching their assignment, how they went about writing their assignment, because sometimes the answers to those can really be quite helpful in understanding where they went wrong so that you can help them to do better next time as an educational intervention. But it can also lead students to tell you things that don't quite match up with what's in their documents. So it can, to a certain extent, act as a viver of, do you actually understand what's in there and why? So I had the experience of talking to a student one time where I said, "Can you tell me about the statistics in your report?" And they told me that there were different statistics in there than they'd actually reported. So then I asked them about the kinds of statistics that were in their submitted report, and they weren't familiar with them and couldn't really explain what they were. And that was fairly suggestive to me that they hadn't written that or that they had some help beyond what they really should have. So a standard set of interviewing questions questions that are relatively open-ended that allow students to either incriminate themselves, lack of a better word, really give you a decent explanation for what's gone on that you can verify against other information that you have in the text of their assignment.
Excellent. I think you just gave me a couple of other thoughts in regards to some things that could also apply to the assessment design phases as well. Is that level of educating the students of the need to know, to be sure about what they're responding and be able to talk back and engage in that level of reflective work. My final question today is going to just to hear your thoughts about the topic, if you have any other thoughts with regards to the topic at hand today, and most importantly, the need for review of policies, academic integrity policies across institutions. How would you inform that process as an expert in this field?
Hopefully there's some really good resources, particularly developed by Tracy Brotag from the University of South Australia on what makes a good academic integrity policy. So that kind of information is published online that people can see. Really, a good academic integrity policy should be clear and transparent to students about what is expected, what's not expected, clear and transparent to staff about what rules and procedures that they should follow in the case of an academic integrity breach. It should be educative, but also should deliver consequences. And it's something that the policy itself is a starting point, but it's something that needs to be followed. So whatever's going on with the policy, whether it's enforcing cases of academic misconduct or monitoring what students are doing, what kind of breaches of academic conduct are coming up, that kind of stuff should be recorded and reported up through university hierarchies. Not just it's not enough to just say we have a policy and that's good enough. So the policy should be a living, working document, and ideally there should be some involvement in of staff and experts who deal with academic integrity issues in updating policies. Keeping them up to date is important because new kinds of problems emerge. As we've noted in recent years, things like commercial file sharing sites have capacity for students to upload an assignment they've done and the students somewhere else in the world to download that assignment and submit it somewhere else. And those kinds of file sharing sites, they potentially have a role in providing educational information to and from other people, but also they potentially have a role in breaching copyright or in some cases facilitating cheating and plagiarism. Now, university doesn't have a policy about the use of those sites. It's very hard for them to then say to students, you shouldn't have been uploading all your course material to these sites when there's nothing in the policy that says that that's a problem. So the policies have to keep up to date with what's going on.
That brings us to the end of this very unique episode on Integrity Matters by Turnitin. We've been exploring the psychology of academic cheating and trying to understand how we go about investigating and detecting cheating in institutions. I want to say a big thank you to Dr. Guy Curtis of University of Western Australia for being with us today. And I hope anyone watching this can learn from his experience and his expertise in how they approach academic cheating at institutions.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.